It's now time to think outside the box of what we've always known.
I myself will tend my sheep and have them lie down, declares the sovereign Lord.
I think that's a profound turning point in somebody's relationship with God.
And our hope in starting this was that this would become an ever-expanding conversation.
Just two real guys talking about life. That's a nice tagline.
I'm Wayne Jacobson.
And I'm Brad Cummings.
And welcome to another edition of The God Journey.
Traveling anywhere. You've been around here for a couple weeks. What's up with that?
It's Master's Week.
Oh, Master's Week.
Master's Week.
You and Jesus taking walks in the garden? Oh, you're talking about golf, the other guy.
It's holy. It's Holy Week.
They
play the Master's Golf Tournament. I've always made that.
At the same time as Easter. That's interesting.
So it doesn't always directly overlap, but it's always clear. And it's no good to travel on Easter week anyway. People are not home. People are not anywhere. And actually, I've been staying home because we've been doing a lot more publicity kinds of things for. So you don't want
you're on the radio everywhere. That's great.
I tell you what, every morning I get up at 6 o'clock for some East Coast radio station to do some kind of interview.
That's fun.
Yeah, it's been fun. Newsweek came out with a big article this week about the whole Christian influence diminishing in America, and our good friend Albert Moeller appears there. Did you?
Yes, I did. I checked that out, and I also was watching Larry King. He's talking to good old Joel Osteen and about all that other stuff, and Joel just thought everything was fine.
Everything was good?
Everything's fine.
Albert Moeller didn't think things are so good.
I know. He thought Albert's a really intelligent guy, but he just sees it different.
Ah, he does. And I think what he's saying is his version of religion is definitely declining, and
Albert's?
Yes.
Joel's is doing fine.
Yeah, Joel, that's another story. I'm not sure I want to go there. But it's that whole idea of God in this angry, arrogant, got to take over culture kind of box. And I think what the Newsweek thing is showing is people are tired of that. Even people like us, people of faith, are tired of that version of Christianity being the dominant voice in the world. And so people are turning their backs on it.
Yeah, it is no longer the dominant voice of the world. It may be one of the loudest, noising clangs and gongs, but it just seems to be falling on deaf ears at a moment when people are starting to say, can we talk about how people do get along? It does seem like that message out of that camp with its militancy is a little off-putting.
Yeah, it says we need to own the culture. We've got to take America back for God.
And if you read through the Gospels, it's interesting. That doesn't seem to be how Jesus related with the culture.
No, I got my concordance out last night. I couldn't find America anywhere in the New Testament. I looked.
Dude, you got the
wrong
scroll.
Not even in the Greek.
You got to talk to Joseph Smith. He found those other scrolls that did have America in it.
By name?
I don't know. We're lost tribes, dude.
See the BYU newspaper called the Quorum of the 12 Apostles, the 12 Apostates?
A little typo
on the photo.
That's funny.
It was funny.
I didn't see that.
I thought, I'm not
sure.
Don't
let that go? Wow.
Yeah, got through. Now heads will roll. I said, no one needs to be punished, but they do want to find out how it happened so it doesn't happen again. There should have been three proofreaders catch the fact that they were calling the 12 apostles the 12 apostates. So,
wow.
That's pretty interesting.
Woohoo!
But yeah, when you get back to how Jesus talked about the culture, even himself, he didn't come to conform culture to his standards or ethics or mandates. He came to win a people who were lost in sin back to his Father's affection.
Yeah.
So it's crazy that people want to die on that hill. And even with that, and all the hand-wringing over, Christianity's finished in America. 75% of people still identify themselves as Christian in America. So that's still a substantial number of our 330 million people.
I just wonder if it wouldn't be better served to have a dialogue as opposed to defining, what they should be talking about. What are they talking about? Where are people at? I find that when you actually listen in conversations, you learn a ton of stuff. And I think there's a lot of people out there, as far as spiritual hunger, that's massively on the rise. People are trying to figure out what's going on and where they fit into it. But I think what they're saying is the standard little, harangues that have been given, they're not working and they're not meeting people where they live.
And I don't think people like Albert Mueller and Dobson and Colson really realize how much their rhetoric is turning people off. The very people they would, I would hope, want to win to Christ. Maybe you give that up at some point. I think maybe you just kind of want to. And I think when I was kind of trapped in a lot of that religious thinking, you really are comfortable with the haves and the have-nots. The people who have God should be blessed, should get their way. Culture should flow along their desires. And those who don't have God, well, they don't have God. They should be punished or hurt or whatever in some way. And I think I grew up with that. I think you grew up with the misery.
Feeling fine about that.
The misery loves company thing. If I'm miserably righteous, I don't want anybody having a good time in sin. You just don't. And so you really divide this between God's people, which should get their way and should get blessed because they're right, and people in the world who are having too much fun in their stupid sin, and they need to be punished. And if God's not going to do it right away, then maybe culture should do it. And that's kind of that whole political theory of that conservative Christianity that says, it was our nation, we were here first, you guys are ruining it, we're going to take it back. And there's a mass repudiation of
couldn't
that.
The Indians say that?
The Native Americans, you mean?
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, I thought they were here first, and we kind of ran them out.
No, absolutely true, but the scale of that isn't huge. There's not that many of them.
Anymore.
Marginalize them, absolutely.
Before it was a big deal.
Even in the stats on atheists are now up to 3.6 million, which is a 4 times increase. And so they make a big deal of the statistic, but 3.6 million out of 330 million?
It's still 1%.
It's a very tiny bit of people actually going to be in the atheist agnostic camp. So a lot of people claiming to be Christian, but their religious fervor is dying. And there's people hand-wringing over that. I tend to celebrate that.
I don't know if it's just the pockets I'm in. I'm not sure that religious fervor. I mean, it depends on how you define that. I don't think people's passion for things spiritual has changed. I think it's actually increased. I think it is not as weird to talk about. I think things that relate to the supernatural are more accepted as opposed to look, you know, with the dog whistle frequency. I think people are, you know, they go, oh, yeah, I mean, they talk more about that stuff. And I think people really are hungry. It was hilarious. We were at the dinner table last night. And having a wonderful kind of family, you know, talk about just God and Easter and, Taylor says, so where's the bunny come up?
The bunny?
You know, Easter.
In scripture, you mean?
Yeah. Yeah. So we had some wonderful conversations, and at the end of it, she said, Dad, you're a good God teacher. The church doesn't explain any of this stuff. And I'm sitting here going like, so when was the last time you had this big old take on church? And she's seven.
She's seven.
And she's just going like, well, Dad, no. They just were always told this, but I don't get that. And then when I talk with you, I get it. And it was sort of fun to go like, well, you know, I don't know that it's, well, gee, I'm so gifted. It's more like, you know what? Unless we're talking in a context that makes sense to you, it's not going to be a helpful dialogue. I think Albert Mueller and that crowd, they're having a dialogue, but they're not talking with people. So whatever it is that they're trying to bring across, it's not being heard. It's being tuned out. And I think they'd be far more effective if you had a chance to talk in the context of where people are at.
Yeah, and they're holding on to old theological views that no longer communicate with the culture, and they're threatened by anybody who tries to position the language somewhat differently. This is the people that attack the emergent crowd for trying to find different language to tell the story of God's redemption.
It's not different truth.
No, it isn't.
It's truth that communicates because it gets heard.
But the story is threatening because the story doesn't wrap itself around my biases. That's where some of these conservative theologians really get stuck.
Well, I think that's where everybody gets stuck. When I have my little pet doctrines, my pet agenda, and that's what I've got to defend, as opposed to really looking at the story of redemption, I'm stuck around my little flags.
Yeah, and there's nothing more telling about that, I think, than the brewing conflict over penal substitution. My goodness,
what a great term.
What a sad. And there's people that want to defend this thing, penal substitution.
Now, hey, what do you mean by that?
Well, let's go to Wikipedia. Tell them what they mean by it. Penal substitution is a theory of the atonement within Christian theology, especially associated with the Reformed tradition. That'll tell you a lot.
Okay, I'm sure there's people out there that when you say Reformed, what does that mean?
That's the people that derive themselves from Calvinist theology.
And who's he?
Oh, don't go into all that history
no,
stuff.
No, don't care. Now,
I'm not even sure he's a believer, to be honest. I know I just freaked all our Reformed people. The more I read about Tulip and predestination and all the
he's
things.
He's more of a fatalistic kind of guy, isn't he?
Well, Calvinism gets you fatalist. Everything's been decided in advance. So you just, if you're going to be saved, you'll find irresistible grace to move you there. And they need this thing called penal substitution. It argues that Christ, by his own sacrificial choice, was penalized in the place of sinners, substitution, thus satisfying the demands of justice so God can justly forgive sins. It is thus a specific understanding of substitutionary atonement where the substitutionary nature of Jesus' death is understood in the sense of substitutionary punishment.
That's Wikipedia?
Yes, Wikipedia.
Wow.
They have a pretty good definition of it.
Smart people.
But what I've noticed on the blogs and stuff that I track and kind of keep my hands on, there's a growing arm of the church that I don't even say the church, the growing arm of religion, of the Christian religion, that is threatened by all the God love talk, threatened by books like He Loves Me or The Shack.
That's too nice.
And are making a stand now that penal substitution is the essence of Christianity. That if you don't believe in that, you are not a Christian. That's the line they're drawing now. And one of the ways they're doing it, Paul Young's supposed to be with the Gaithers for some kind of celebration thing here in May. And there's some of these people are putting some real pressure on the Gaithers to cancel Paul out because he was on some radio show and said he wasn't for penal substitution. It wasn't his belief, to which how that plays out in the blog.
Then he denies the atonement of Jesus Christ.
That's
the quick little parallel that they put there, and it's like, well, that's not exactly accurate.
Yeah, that's the A equals B that doesn't. If you don't believe in penal substitution, you don't believe in substitutionary atonement. And Paul's been very clear, as have I, as have you, we do believe in substitutionary atonement. Jesus took our place. Not to get whacked by God, not that God needed to sate himself by punishing something so he could justly forgive sin, but Jesus took our place with the disease of sin so that God could cure it in himself, so that God could take what we could not bear and provide the cure. And when you look at God as the curer of sin, and this is going to air on Good Friday, it's a great day to talk about this stuff, because I was taught, I think, penal substitution. I was taught God's angry.
Yes.
We've sinned. The holy God's justice has been offended. He can't just forgive, because forgiving would just somehow...
It's excusing.
Yeah, it would undermine.
You're just letting it go, and that would say that God's word and his laws and everything that he said is important.
Yeah, and it doesn't... So he can't just forgive. What he asks us to do numerous times in the New Testament, forgive as you've been forgiven. Well, if I've been forgiven only because
you
God
just gotta find somebody that
to
you
beat
go
the crud out of. That's exactly right.
And then it's fine.
Forgive us, you've been forgiven. Okay. God had to whoop something to death. I've used this analogy a lot because I think why we have a difficult time getting people to embrace a God of love and a God of grace is because to enter into a relationship with a God who had to brutalize his own son for us to reengage the relationship really sets up a pretty abusive kind of God, doesn't it?
Well, you end up being very thankful for Jesus. Like, wow, I don't even know what to say to him. But then do I want to hang out with his father who seems to be a rageaholic? No. I don't know that I really want to get close to the father because I'm pretty sure I'm going to screw up again and he's going to have to beat the snot out of somebody again or do something.
Well, they'll say he did it once and for all. Jesus got beat for everything. But then the reformers are going to say, not for everyone, only for certain people. So they got a problem with that. I mean, I got a problem with that starting out.
See, we had fun at the dinner table last night because we made this personal. I got Jared Moldist and Taylor, my youngest, sitting on one side, and Jonathan's on the other. And I said, all right, guys, here's the deal. Y'all have messed up. And they would go, like, okay, that's true. I mean, we talked about sin in terms of that, you know, have you ever wanted to do something that you knew was right and then no one was around and you just had that little inkling like, well, I don't really want to do that. I want to do this in that sense of you know No one's around. So, I mean, you could get off scot-free, but you already know. I'm choosing to do something that I know. I said, we talked that, there's sin, guys. We talked about that. And you've all done that. And they all kind of, yeah, yeah. I said, well, what if the deal was somebody has to really experience a massive punishment and again, beat the snot out of them? You know, why don't we draw straws? And it's like, oh, Jonathan, sorry. And I said, Taylor, how do you feel? Well, she felt bad for Jonathan, but she was happy it wasn't her.
Good by me, yeah, absolutely.
And Jared kind of went,
the short stick.
Wow, this is – and Jared's thinking, well, this is fair now because he feels like a lot of times he gets in trouble. It's a you have this pitting against – and Jonathan's sitting there with just his mouth just wide open going like, this isn't fair. This isn't right. Wrong. And I'm just going like, here's the problem when we interpret – what Easter's about through that lens is it doesn't seem right. It doesn't seem fair. It doesn't draw me close. I said, is that what's going on the cross? If God could have done anything, why did he choose that? And then we talked about, you know, the whole idea of maybe there's that disease thing, sin inside us that has to be cured somehow. We talked about viruses. We talked about diseases. We talked about snake bite and venom and how do you produce anti-venom.
That's exciting having dinner at the
Curry Council. Oh, it is. It's a blast. We had a wonderful talk, but we put it in language where it's like, oh, if something's wrong that needs to be changed and there's only one way to do that, then the cross was starting to make sense as something that God proactively was happy to do, to choose to do, to bring about a positive end as opposed to satisfy some anger. And all of a sudden, my kids, I'm just looking at my kids, and they're going like, yeah, I like this. I mean, it's reframing everything for them. And I sat there going, wow, their mindset, when they recognize that, you know what, I want to do the things that are right, but there is that thing in me that I can't explain to you, Mommy, Daddy, but I do the wrong things. I'm sorry. I really am sorry. I don't know why I do that. I said, that's that thing that Jesus wants to cure and fix inside us.
Yeah, and the penal substitution view, in my mind, the biggest negative against it is how it frames God. You've got God being the one who Jesus is saving us from. It's the Father's anger, even the word wrath, which, you know, I wrote a column this week that was on crosswalk.com, and there's already been some people sending me stuff going, how do you say stuff like that? Don't you want, I mean, don't emphasize God's love at the expense of his justice and truth. And I don't think you have to.
I don't think you have to at all.
I think you can be fully engaged with a God of love and affection, and that everything he does, even out of wrath, is not the opposite of his love, it is an expression of his love. And I think that's what penal substitutionists want to separate. Okay, there's a God of love who can be loving at times. To whom? To people who are ingratiating themselves to him, people who are doing his deal. He gets to be kind
to them.
But he's
got to be really ticked off at everyone else.
Well, he's really smoking at sin, boy. He really wants to whack that pretty hard. Bad enough that he's going to take the most innocent human being that ever lived on the face of the earth and brutalize him on a cross. And that, according to penal substitutionists, hey, he took my penalty, so I'm good. I'm golden now.
But what I think that falls short with is even if you did find some verses that they can hang some of those thoughts on, the reality is where's the fix? So that deals with God's anger. That deals with his having a ticked off response to our disobedience. But how does that fix me? How does that change me at all? See, I think the beauty of what Jesus did on the cross is I can be different. It's not just, oh, my slate gets wiped clean. My disease inside that wars against God can be touched by that. There's something of an actual change in my nature that can happen through that exchange that you're just going like, just a punishment view doesn't address that.
Yeah, we've said before, for religion to survive, it has to sustain itself by fear. And one of the best things to have fear and to justify people getting their just desserts. Is this angry God? And we've taken the wrath of God and equated it with anger. We think of it the same way we think about anger in our own. I mean, we know our loving little kids growing up, they're so sweet sometimes, and then there's times when you feel like throwing them through a wall because they just...
They're not so sweet.
They're not so sweet at times. And we've kind of likened that to God. God's like that. God's loving at times when we're sweet, and then other times he wants to throw us through a wall. And that what penal substitution allows is that he gets that angry and he gets to do that. And we all wrapped up in that term we call wrath. And wrath for most people is so equated with, that's another one of those A equals B. Wrath equals anger. Well, no, it doesn't. The root word of wrath in the Old and New Testament, Hebrew and Greek both, is zeal. It's not uncontrollable rage. It's not anger. It's not, I've got to kill something to sate my angst over what people have done. It is zeal. It's the zeal of God that wants to consume what destroys what he loves. And so we've got wrath even in place. Now, so wrath can be said, and I've read it in some of these blogs and interviews, is that wrath is the opposite of God's love. So that God's loving sometimes, but to be just, he also has to be wrathful at other times. And we've separated God from himself when we make wrath just a point of anger to satisfy justice. And I think it misses the point. When people take 2 Corinthians 5 and say, he who knew no sin became sin for us, and they're saying that is the penal substitution verse. That's one of the ones where they hang it on. And you go, yeah, but that's not what it's saying. It's not saying Jesus was guilty of our sins and thus punished, but became infected with sin itself. So the cure of sin could go on inside of the Christ on the cross.
That's why I think it is so helpful. I mean, you do this marvelously in He Loves Me, where you start to reframe an understanding of what happens on the cross in a context of something that's like medicinal and curative. How do you produce, if you got a virus, how do you actually produce the antidote? Well, you have to take something of the disease and you got to find that thing that conquers that. Well, that thing that conquers it is the sinless life of Jesus Christ. He's the only guy out there that walked this thing and never separated himself from his Father.
Because you not only have to have a cure, you have to have the disease in a host that can withstand the cure.
Yep.
And that's what people miss. The reason why a sinless life is so that death wouldn't overtake him before the cure could be effected in the Son. If we last, how long do we last in the Old Testament? God's wrath breaks out. You know, humans last about
not very long.
A microsecond. If it takes 6 hours of wrath to cure sin, if that the time of darkness when Jesus hung on that cross, if it took 6 hours of wrath being poured into our sin that the Son is holding
total
as the host, what hope had you of ever rescuing yourself?
None.
What hope have you ever said? I can take enough punishment for my sin. Thank you very much. No, you couldn't. You couldn't take the cure. You couldn't withstand it. My friend died of melanoma a couple years ago almost now. And the USC gave him the highest measured dose of the chemotherapy we have to deal with melanoma that his body could withstand. And it wasn't enough. It was going to kill him before it could kill the melanoma. That's what it was for us and wrath. We couldn't take enough of the cure before dying. So that the victim, Jesus, takes it on for us, not to jump between us and the Father. See, the penal substitution construct actually has Jesus saving us from God.
And it has God's law as a higher reality than him. He's subject to his own stuff. So it's like the ultimate is not the actual person of God. It's those laws and rules.
Yeah.
And it lifts that up as the pinnacle and just going like, you know what? What it destroys is any desire or context of understanding of intimate relationship.
It leaves you with no, like you said, hey, Jesus is my buddy. Hey, Jesus is going to jump in and take my beating for me.
Love Jesus.
Love that deal. But it does not instill you with affection toward the Father.
And you talk about, well, who is God? I mean, we were talking on a dinner table. It's like if it doesn't pass the test of the 7-year, 11, and 14-year-olds, I don't think it's truth. If they can't grasp it, then it's not really true and it's not clear. I said, who is Jesus? Well, if you have this good God, bad God deal going on, they can't be the same thing. They can't be one and the same. You have no concept of God in human form in Jesus. It's more like, well, Thank God there's that Jesus guy, but I'm not sure how he relates to his angry dad. And you can't bring those two together in that construct.
No, you can't. You've got to keep them poles apart. You've got Jesus. If Jesus saved us from the onrushing train that was about to destroy, so he jumps on the tracks to push us off, as the penal substitutionists tell it, God's the one driving the train. I mean, God's the one bearing down. I mean, I'm sorry, I have to do this. My law makes it essential. To forgive you without killing something negates the law. Instead of the scriptures they use, somebody sent me this in answer to the column I wrote. Said, I'm curious how you interact with scriptures like Hebrews 9:22. Without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness of sin. And I think that, gee, that's an easy one to deal with. Our sin demanded a sacrifice. If God's going to cure this thing, not just forgive it, the forgiveness of sin was easy. God could do that without the cross.
But that's almost like the excusing of sin.
It isn't. Not if God's bent is to cure it.
No, I know. But I mean, when you only have a punishment lens, it's as if, how do we somehow get past this? But you don't fix it. You don't change the actual disease. You don't get rid of it.
No, you don't. It's just a matter of, now my penalty's been paid, I can be a schmuck, and God's still going to like me now. Because he's not angry anymore. He whooped the boy enough that he didn't have it left anymore. And yet, when you can say, I think Hebrews 9 saying, what the Old Testament sacrifices were showing is, it was death was going to be essential for a cure. The death of the Son on the cross, the sacrifice, the willing substitutionary atonement of, I'll take your disease, sin, and I'll hold it in my being in the presence of the love, wrath of the Father, until the language
it's
of Romans 8,
out.
Where God consumes sin in the likeness of sinful flesh. That's not punishment language. That's curative language. And that's what people... So Hebrews 9:22, just as true from the curative approach, my goodness, probably even more true.
Yeah.
Because it's not just about the forgiveness of sin, it's about the curing of sin and reasserting a new life in him that allows us to live increasingly free from the bondage of
sin. I think Paul talks about sin in a wonderful way when he almost personifies it, when he says, you know, the good that I want to do, I don't find myself doing, and the very evil that I am doing that I don't want to do, what is that in me? It's that sin that indwells in me. And who is going to deliver me from this wretched body of death? He's got a disease, there's something wrong, and he needs a cure. The answer is, it is Jesus. And we sort of unpacked that last night at the dinner table. I think for the first time, my kids are going like, oh, that's what's going on there. Now, that's attractive. That makes sense. That has some direct benefit that makes me go, wow, God, you're amazing.
And that's Romans 7 you're quoting. And Romans 8 is exactly Paul's takeaway of the cross. Paul's saying, now we know that neither life nor death nor principalities, nothing's going to separate us from the love of God. How do you get that? From the cross. Not Jesus, the good guy. But God the Father working in the Son to accomplish our redemption. When he comes away from the cross, exactly like your kids did, wow.
Yeah.
Isn't God amazing?
Yeah. You end up going like, this is amazing. How come people don't know this? You don't have to go tell a little kid that just gets that. Other kids ought to know that.
Yeah.
They instantly go like, you know, people don't know that. And yeah. I'm going like, exactly. Because if all Christianity is about is trying to behave well, and it's knowing the rules and seeing how you score, well, then frankly, you're kind of happy when you see a bunch of screw-ups because you feel better about yourself. I mean, you end up on this little competitive, religious, righteous little treadmill, and it's all fun and games till you trip and fall and end up on the discard pile. And it's like, you know what? When you frame this in a sense of going like, you know what? I want to be someone. We talked about sin as that whole archery term, like, you know, it misses the mark. And it's kind of like, wouldn't you want to, if you could hit the bullseye, wouldn't you want to? And the answer is, well, yeah, I would. Well, what's that thing inside us that keeps wicking it to the right, to the left? What's that? That's that sin thing. If God could actually do something with that, wouldn't you want that? Absolutely. Wasn't a little face there that didn't say, gee, sign me up.
Right.
And there you sort of deal, like, so many people that are going, well, your God's too nice. You're going, like, I don't see the downfall in that. I see the attraction. And I'm not saying sin doesn't matter. We're saying sin can be dealt with. Sin can be addressed in that way, in a way that starts to change me and empower me to live a different life.
And I'm wondering if that's what penal substitutionists don't see. In the long run, it's the same kind of Pharisee, misery loves company kind of mentality. If I've got to not be sinning anymore, then I want to make sure people who are really get what they deserve. They really got
Yeah,
it.
Somehow they can't get away with
that. And the line in the shack that caused some grief with some people, which is, God, it's not my job to punish sin, it's my desire to free people from it. And people are just going, what? God's not punishing sin? You really want God? Who wants to be on that side? I want God punishing sin. I want God, and the only way you can
My hand's
there,
not up because I'm pretty sure I'd be wiped out.
I used to live there. Because when you're a legalist, and before my pharisectomy, when I thought, yeah, I do have this right. I am working harder than anyone else I know to live righteously. But I'm not having fun. Those people out there are having fun. They're doing the free drugs of the 60s and LSD, dropping acid and having sex with girls in high school. And I'm that goody righteous two-shoes guy. You really do, like the older brother and the prodigal. You want the bad guys punished.
They're going to get their comeuppance, yeah.
I think
this isn't fair.
Religionists live by the need to punish. So framing this penal substitution thing, it works for them. It works. God needs to whack somebody because sinners are having too much fun.
And you know who they could actually, if they got this, they could actually have fun whacking? Is that there is that guy, Satan. And the cross is a direct slam dunk on that guy. And I don't know. I mean, there's not everything about this book that I love, but there's Destined for the Throne by Paul Bilheimer.
That's an oldie.
That, to me, is a wonderful classic. And it does, I think, do a great job of talking about the cross in a judicial standpoint. But it's not God needing to punish sin. It's how God triumphs over the devil. In the cross, in the terms of, if the wages of sin is death, okay, Romans, clear verse. If the wages of sin is death, well, there is a consequence to sin. And there is a wage to it. I think that's where a lot of these people get that kind of language and concepts. Well, the devil gets free reign. If all he has a power of influence, and we agree with him, then he gets free reign to sort of bring out that punishment. But you bring all of a sudden an innocent person along? That he cannot exact a death penalty on? Because he never sinned. And he conspires to get the people to crucify Jesus? Why would God ever allow that? Why would he go along with it? Well, in that very act of being the instigator of crucifying Christ, he becomes a murderer that he wasn't before. Everyone else to that point was guilty. And he could exact whatever it was. In Christ, all of a sudden you got an innocent person. And you got Satan trying to get a death penalty thing. And the reality is he becomes a murderer. If you read, you got a quizzical look on me.
Well, I'm not seeing the devil as God's executioner carrying out the deal. I'm not.
I know.
Other people are comfortable with that analogy. I am not. Because I didn't think the wages of sin is death is really God saying, if the soul that sins doesn't die, then sin gets to be eternal. So that God contains sin by death. I think even that is an act of mercy. So, yes, the culmination of our sin is death because God condemned sin to the finite age. I guess I've not really seen Satan as his executioner. So, now we finally got Satan on something because we had him on something long before he murders.
What I do take out of it that I find that is valuable is that so many times when people are looking at this whole punishment thing, they're looking as if we're the object that God's got to somehow, he's got to punish that wrongdoer. Ultimately, I think that kind of focus is on Satan and his host. It isn't on the human beings of God's loving creation. They're more like the kidnapped royalty. And he's trying to redeem us. I don't believe he's trying to redeem Satan and that host.
No, I'm pretty sure he's not. Nor am I thinking he's got to pay them back something for us. That whole ransom thing in the sense of, you know, the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe and the White Witch, because Edmund did his betrayal thing and she owes him and Aslan's got to pay him back. There's a lot of that analogy. I'm thinking it doesn't work for me. God doesn't owe Satan anything. He doesn't have to buy something back from Satan, at least in my view of it. My view of it is sin has got to be redeemed in us so that we can live free. People who know the love of God. And I know this is what the religionists are concerned with. You talk about God being too loving, people are just going to live in sin and not care. The reality is, you engage the love of the living God, you'll want to be like him. Righteousness becomes your passion, not righteousness. Well, okay, I've got to do it now because I'm one of God's kids. And I think that changes everything about the way you look at stuff like this. So you don't need the people to be punished. You don't have to have stuff. What you do is you have an opportunity to live life very differently, to live life inside the reality of God. And some of this language from our penal substitutionist friends, it's not merely preached, but it's written that Jesus Christ became sin for us, 2 Corinthians 5:21. Again, the purpose of that was not judicial. The purpose of that in 2 Corinthians 5 is reconciliation. It's relational. It's not God saying, okay, I've satisfied the law, now I can love you. It's God wanting to reconcile us out of where sin broke us and destroyed us. The cup that he drank was the cup of God's wrath. I believe that, absolutely. His just punishment for sin. That's where I go, put the word cure there. The cure God needed to set us free. It's hard to read the Bible and not see that God hates sin. I agree. And indeed, all sin will be dealt with. For some, it has been dealt with on the cross. For others, they will face the wrath of God themselves. And then he concludes, in our desire to see God as loving and merciful, I would caution us not to forget that God is holy and just. I don't know why people always have to, you know, you're talking about God being loving.
They come back there to a very angry God that must be appeased.
Because I tell you what, God can be fully loving and merciful and fully holy and just. To me, that's not a two sides of the scales. So you've got to
keep sides of the schizophrenic God.
Yeah, it's one reality. And for people to argue, as some are wanting to do right now, penal substitution is the essence of Orthodox Christianity. Again, a phrase that's not even found in
Orthodox
Scripture.
Religion.
Yeah, a phrase that's not even found in Scripture. I know some people are going to use this verse, and I was going to ask what you thought of this, because Psalm 53:10, this comes up, or Isaiah 53 also comes up in the same context. Yet it was the will of God to crush him. He has put him to grief.
If you're looking at a medicinal view, that there's no problem there, because you're just going, you know what? God's working out a cure. There is his place. If it is vengeful wrath and God is taking glee, I start to back up going, who is this God?
Yeah, see, I don't see any conflict with that. People pull that stuff out and going, it was the will of the Lord to crush him. If the crushing was the cure,
yeah.
If that was part of what had to happen, that's very different than an angry God going, wow, I finally get to crush something, and now we're going to even the ledger. It's just nuts.
Yeah, I think the value in looking at some of the judicial standpoint is that, as opposed to people feeling like, you know, God's got this standard he's got to make happen, there is language in there. I mean, I will give the other camps a thought. There are verses that do talk about sort of a judicial dimension. I just think it really is part of that triumphing over sin, death, and the devil that Jesus is on the cross. That's where you can understand some of that. But if you don't frame that in the context of relationship, and if you don't frame that in the fact that God isn't just trying to say, you know what, the standard was broken, I got to somehow reconcile the banking scale. It's I got to get that disease out of my children, or they're going to stay stuck. They're going to stay separate from me because their whole life's going to be whipped in a weird way.
Yeah, and most of the language of punishment does come from the Old Testament. And I know this really gets into biblical interpretation, but when you've got people still filled with shame, looking forward to redemption they can't understand, they're caught up in that whole false God, shame-based mentality that says deities are angry beings needing appeasement because of our sin. That's the framework with which some of them interpreted what they saw down the road.
And the Old Testament sacrificial system did seem to be, and maybe people are going to react to this, did seem to be in measure a shame management dynamic.
And it was very much copied from the secular culture.
Yeah, and it's like, okay, will God jump in that and lead us to? Yeah, he'll jump in that and he'll lead those people to an ultimate place where, you know what, you don't have to keep killing your goats. You don't have to keep doing this management thing. There's therefore now no condemnation, not just covering it for a year, but I can get rid of it. And I think that some of the Old Testament, you know, verses that they go off of, I think so much of the penal substitution group, they're still stuck in that management of sin and shame and standards, and they haven't migrated into a relationship that brings about a cure.
And I think the Bible is clear on this. It can, even in the Old Testament, says these sacrifices were never meant to work. None of this is reality.
They were a type and a shadow of the substance to come.
It was, but you have to wonder, because these sacrificial things were already going around in false religions in Canaan when Abraham is there and Moses is moving the children of God there, that God's not giving his own people kind of a religious reality to, like you said, manage the shame for the purpose of leading them out of it. Not saying it's valid, this is what it really is, but I'm going to lead you to a reality that transcends this. And when you get to the New Testament, for penal substitutionists to be right, Christ had to die for God. Christ's death satisfied something in the Father, his need for justice, his need to punish, his need to be true to the law, whatever it is that they're saying.
He wouldn't be complete in himself without that.
Right. But the New Testament keeps saying on and on, Christ died for me.
Us.
What the cross satisfied was not something in God. The cross satisfied my bondage, my self-preferring nature, my broken trust with the Creator. The cross saw something in me that opens the door to relationship. That is the resounding message of the New Testament. And people who don't get that really miss out on who God is and how it is that we learn to walk with Him.
Yeah, and if all of this is where God isn't forcing relationship, to me, the beauty of what Christ did is nobody forced him to the cross. Nobody made that happen. He willingly gave. He laid down his life. It wasn't taken from him. He laid it down. And there's something about that where you're just going like, now, wait a minute. If all of this is in that preferred language of I'm giving, I am yielding, the punishment dynamic, the residue of what you're left with, is a really confused understanding of that same person. Why, if he is able to, quote, lay down his life, does he have to be so demanding, exacting over here with demanding a punishment? Those two people don't seem like the same one.
No, they're not. And the language of the New Testament, again, is always about was the Father's good pleasure for all his fullness to be in the Son and through the Son to reconcile all things to himself. So you really have, in the language of the, Jesus is the exact representation of the Father's nature. So Jesus' passion to redeem broken humanity. Jesus didn't come here to punish it. He didn't go hang out with tax gatherers and sinners so he could whoop up on them, getting ready for the day when God was going to whoop up on him for everybody else. The reality of the New Testament is so different that I think it undermines this penal substitution dynamic. And what we miss is, and I've had a number of people tell me this, I've not done a lot of reading into Eastern Orthodox theology, but I've done enough to know that this idea of penal substitution never found its way into our brothers and sisters who are more Eastern Orthodox. They celebrate a cross that was curative. They don't celebrate a cross that finally God got all his anger out
judicial.
On his boy. Yeah. And I'm thinking, wow, now that's something we may not have wanted to migrate from whenever we became the Western Roman church that needed fear, needed terrified people to conform their behavior. Exactly. And I think that's where penal substitution really derives its source.
And when you look at Hebrews, I mean, if Jesus is that ultimate picture of the Father, then how do you get the good cop, bad cop differentiation? You can't. You don't end up with a bad cop. It's a good cop and a good cop. You don't have a cop. It's like if that is Jesus, if his heart to the broken, to the lost, when you look at how Jesus deals with sinners in the Gospels, if that is the fullness of God reflected to us, then where do you get the idea that the vengeful, wrathful, judicial punisher, why wasn't Jesus meeting that out to all the people that were breaking the rules?
Yeah. Well, we're going to hear more about this because, honestly, I think this is where the lines are now being drawn.
Lines being drawn in the sand?
Yeah, between the religionists that want to guard an Orthodox theology of God and the cross as penal substitution, and a group of people God's awakening to a different reality that was, it was never about punishment. It wasn't that I needed to punish something to love you. It was that I needed to reconcile something in you that kept you from me. We're going to hear more about this because there's a whole camp of people that are now going to take penal substitution to the wall and judge anybody who doesn't fit into that little orthodox view. So we'll hear more.
That's all right. Jesus probably doesn't fit their view either.
Thank you for traveling with us on the God Journey. You can be part of the conversation by visiting our website, thegodjourney.com.